Great job. Thank you, buddy.
Wow, thank you so much, Michael. My name's Matthew. I have alcoholism. I want to thank Ben for getting me here. We say it differently where I'm from, but I didn't want to offend anyone. I also want to thank Lee's Tapes for the very sophisticated lighting system we have. Thank you, Lee. You guys been hearing the music for 2 days of Alcoholics Anonymous? Let's hear it, man. I have. I've been hearing it. I love AA. I've been listening to every single person, moved by every single person, touched and changed some thoughts by the way people have shared their experience. And there's just these moments in time that people have shared about, and they change the direction of people's lives. And I want to talk about that with the ninth step. But before I do that, I'm a musician, and I was listening to Teresa, and I'm thinking, what album has this weekend been? And I thought, it might be Led Zeppelin, Houses of the Holy, right? And then I went, no, it's the Stones, Beggar's Banquet, right? And then I realized, walking back to my room, it's the frickin' White Album, man. It's the Beatles' White Album. We started off with Back in the USSR, you know? And then Tara spoke about God. We had Blackbird for a little while. And then we had the beautiful Tammy do Ubladi Ublada, which I will say, life goes on, right? And it's just gotten better and better and better, you guys. And I'm thrilled, honored. I can't think too much about the fact that I'm standing in front of this mic right now. So what I want to do is talk about these little moments in time that changed the direction of all of our lives that happened way before AA started. I want to tell a little story about how we got the ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a really fascinating story. I'm sure there are some people here who know the story. But for those of you who don't, I just want to share this, because when I learned this after I'd been sober for a while, it really, really touched me. So I'm going to start with this guy, this young Presbyterian minister. He was in Philadelphia, and he started a home for homeless boys through his church. And he was really good at turning these kids' lives around. And he fed them really well, and he taught them how to get a spiritual life. And he was very successful. But the board of directors looked at the budget, and they said, you're spending too much money on the food. And he basically said, how can we talk about the love of God and then feed them beans and rice? And they said, beans and rice, you got to quit. And he quit. And he got all this resentment. Not an alcoholic. This guy named Frank, priest named Frank. And he became so dejected, and his power to help change people's lives left him. And he didn't know why. And his family was worried about him, so they sent him on a little trip. And he went around Europe, and he went to England. And in 1908, on July 27th, he went to this little church in Keswick, England, looking for somebody. It seems like he's an alcoholic because he went on the wrong day. But that's how God works, right? And he's sitting there in a church. There's only 17 other people in the church, and he's thinking about how much he hates these six people that ruined the good thing he had going. And the woman minister came out and started speaking about the cross of God. Little church, 17 people, and he looked up at the cross, and it shifted right in front of his eyes, and it became the letter I. And he moved from blame to responsibility. And that's one of those moments of grace. He saw very clearly it wasn't them. It was him. He was in what we call in Alcoholics Anonymous the bondage of self. And the thing about the bondage of self is you don't know you're in it. It's very baffling that way. And one of the key measurements for me to know if I'm in the bondage of self is if I'm blaming you. Or I'm afraid. Self-centered fear. I love that the book says self-centered fear. In all of my sobriety, I have had other-centered fear, maybe for 5 minutes. Most of my fear is self-centered, right? But this guy went back to the hotel, and he wrote letters to all six people, and the letters went like this. I'm writing to tell you that I have harbored an unkind feeling towards you. At times I conquered it, but it always came back. Our views may differ, but as brothers we must love. I write to ask your forgiveness and to assure that I love you, and I trust by God's grace I shall never more speak unkindly or disparagingly of you again. And the man who wrote those letters was Frank Buchman. And a lot of you know who he is. The thing that's most profound about that moment is he changed when he mailed them. He didn't change when they got them. He changed when he put them in the mailbox, and he knew he changed because he turned around, he started walking through the lobby, and he felt elated, lifted up, free. And remember, he was dejected. And there was a man pacing in the lobby from Cambridge University, and he said, "I'm lost. My life's a mess." And Frank sat down with him and changed his life, got him to turn his will and his life over. And he knew he was healed because his power came back. So that was 1908. 1917, 9 years later. So there, that's where it started, little town in England. He goes to China in 1917. This is how our amends got to us. He went from England to China. In China, he met up with this young minister who was trying to help the Chinese students and convert them and help them be spiritual people. And I'm not talking about a particular religion for me. I'm just telling you the story. And he was ineffective. And Frank said, "Why do you think you're ineffective?" And he goes, "Yeah, I don't like Chinese people. And I don't like China very much." And Frank said, "I bet you they can tell." And he said, "Sam, you got to go make amends to your class." And this guy, Sam Shoemaker, went to his class the next day and apologized and said, "I'm going to amend my behavior." And he said, "I don't like China." And they all went, "We know." Right? And he immediately started to have an effect on these people because he was relieved from the bondage of self and the power flowed through him. So then the next character in our story, this is in Massachusetts. So Frank starts moving through life and putting together these moments, these little moments where he's like, "Wow, this happened," or "I did this," or "I started behaving this way, and I changed." Right? And he made these little steps. And there were four of them. And the third one was restitution to all who we wrong directly or indirectly. Sound familiar? So he's starting his little meetings. There's no Oxford group yet, but he's starting these little things. They call them house parties eventually, and they look just like this. But this guy, Jim Newton, he's my favorite guy in the story. Jim Newton was a salesman in Massachusetts, and I had been a salesman for a while in my life, and he was walking through this hotel, and he saw all these girls run into this ballroom, like I watched earlier. And he chased them in there, thinking it was a dance. And it was an Oxford group house party. And it changed his life. He sat down and he listened and he was moved. And he went up to Frank Buchman. He goes, I'm in trouble, man. I'm not living right. And he goes, "Here, let me introduce you to my friend Sam. He lives closer to where you live in New York City." And the reason that Jim Newton, who's in this picture, I'm sorry, this is the worst picture. I had a better one, but I couldn't find it. But this is a picture of two people. This is a picture of Jim Newton and Bud Firestone. So Bud Firestone was a ne'er-do-well alcoholic. His dad owned Firestone Tires. And he couldn't change. He couldn't stop drinking. And Jim Newton took him to the Calvary Chapel, and he helped him, and he got him to change. He got him to become sober. And Bud Firestone was so impressed by this, or not Bud Firestone, his father, the senior, that he said, "Hey, you guys should have a big meeting in this little town called Akron, Ohio." So that was coming up in 1933. But parallel to this, in New York, there's this other guy, Roland Hazard. And a lot of you have read about Roland, and you may not know it. He's the guy that went to see Carl Jung, right? And he couldn't stop drinking. He had the best psychotherapist on earth, and he couldn't stop drinking. And he went to New York, and he ended up getting involved with the Calvary Chapel where Sam Shoemaker was, and he changed his life. And he became full of this new force and the spirit. And what they knew that we know is you have to pass it on. My sponsor says you don't give it away to get it, you give it away, or give it away to keep it, you give it away to get it. And so he was looking for somebody to help. But at that time, there was this meeting in Akron, Ohio, and these people all came to the meeting, and this one woman, Henrietta, was quite sucked into the system of Oxford Group and the four steps. And she started this. So Henrietta Seibeling, 1933 in Akron, Ohio. Roland Hazard, 1933, New York. You see how the powers are about to converge? So because of England, Keswick, China, Massachusetts, Akron, New York, Roland Hazard goes, I know a guy who needs some help. This is a great story. I love this story. It's been verified by a few people. This guy had been sent out. He was a rich guy, not Roland, a friend of the family's, wealthy family, and he was a terrible drunk, and they sent him off to paint the summer house, and he would paint the summer house and drink all day. But it's summertime, so the pigeons would come and poop on this paint. So he would shoot at them with a shotgun and take pieces of the house away, but he got rid of the pigeons. So thus, alcoholics enter our story. And one day, he was coming home. One day, it was like 3 in the morning, and you know, back then they had these giant cars, big Packard, and he's drunk, and he misses the driveway, and he drives through the lady's house next door. True story. And he ends up in her kitchen, and she just got up. She's making breakfast, and he opens the door, gets out of the car, and says, ma'am, do you have any coffee? It's true story. And that guy's name was Ebby Thatcher. Ah, the penny dropped. So Ebby Thatcher's going to go to jail for a really long time. And Roland Hazard goes before the judge and says, I think we can help this guy. Can you give him to us? And he's from a wealthy family. They don't want the trouble. They go, look, if you can do something with him, go do something with him. And Ebby Thatcher, when he was, I don't know, 60 days on this, doing this, he goes, I know a guy that could be helped by this. I know a guy I can help. His name's Bill Wilson. I'm going to go over to Bill's house. And Bill sat across the kitchen from him, and we all heard the story, but after Bill accepts the idea of a higher power, he said, my schoolmate visited me, says a couple of days later, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Exactly like it says in those steps. That's the ninth step, being born in our program. So Ebby Thatcher gets Bill to start doing this. Bill goes to Akron, Ohio, where Henrietta Seiberling's got these Oxford group meetings, and he has these people come over, Dr. Bob and Ann. And Bob can't get sober. And then when Bill comes to town, Henrietta knows enough to put him together with Bob. Bob can't get sober. Does anybody know what happened the day that we trace back to our Founders Day? What happened with Bob that day? He made amends. Dr. Bob Smith decided he didn't make amends before this because he thought it would ruin his reputation. You're a drunk proctologist, man. How much worse can it get? And he went around town and he made amends. And that power between those two men has unfolded and unfolded and unfolded. And we're sitting here today because of that. So let me ask you something. Now that you know that story, doesn't this sentence sound a little different? The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. That's right in the middle of the ninth step. That's right in the middle. I used to read that where I got sober in Hermosa Beach, California. They all have these meetings. They're like, read a section of the big book and share about it. And probably 50% of the people read that paragraph. The spiritual life is not a theory. You have to live it. And I always thought I must be in the third step. Or very likely it's in the 11th step. It's not. It's in the ninth step. It's where you start living a spiritual life. This isn't a personal decision. This isn't a willingness to open up. This is go out and right your wrongs, just like happened in 1908 in Keswick, England, and flew all around the world and wound up in our program because it was recognized as a moment of grace by Frank Buchman. It was recognized as a moment of grace by Sam Shoemaker. It was recognized as a moment of grace by Jim Newton, Roland Hazard, Henrietta Seiberling, Bill Wilson, They saw this thing I did changed me, and I didn't go back to how I was. Tara said it the other day. I turned my will and my life over to God. I jumped out of an airplane. I can't jump back in. And once you've done this work, it changes you, right? You know, there's a beautiful part of the big book. If I didn't lose my place. Yeah. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. I'm going to save some of that. Because now I want to talk about my experience. And that's the other thing I can tell you, listening today and last night. You know, I'm 30 years sober. I got sober May 16th, 1993, when I was 30 years old. So I'm a little older than that now. And being 60 years old and 30 years sober, I feel like this program seems to get better and better. You guys seem to be doing it better. But I think it's my ears, right? I'm hearing it better. And coming to this tonight was just like I had an experience with Paul when we were overseas. I've had a lot of experiences with Bill where I've started to realize one of the beautiful spiritual aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I know there's people in here that probably have truck with the God thing. And I always like to say, but let's all agree there's grace, right? There's grace. But one of the elements I love about Alcoholics Anonymous that I've just become more aware of, probably since COVID maybe, because I've just been, it's been delivered in different ways. And we're kind of back out on the road now meeting people. And I was listening from Cliff till Teresa. And I was listening to the music. And I was thinking, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and at its very roots, it's a spiritual program because our only currency in Alcoholics Anonymous is our experience. We don't care what you did for a living or who you do for a living. We don't care what's going on in your life. But there is no hierarchy here. There's a phase people go through where they think there is, and then life intervenes and we're all humbled again, right? And we're just all the same. And the cool thing that makes you know this is a spiritual program is my son, for instance, had his car wrecked. And this is true. He was not at fault. Someone hit his car. It was the first time ever it wasn't his fault. And he's kind of doing well. And he called and said, Dad, you know, can you lend me $5,000 to help me buy a car? Well, I had it. And he's my son. So I gave it to him. And after I gave it to him, I noticed that I had $5,000 less in my bank account, and he had $5,000 more. And that's the way the material world works. But we come here, and we give away our one currency, our experience, and somehow we leave richer. That's spirituality. So whatever you think about God, the white-bearded guy in the sky, or Jesus, who doesn't like you particularly, or whatever your problem is with religion, don't worry. I was thinking about this too, watching Tammy and Cliff and Lori. Lori just blew my mind. I was thinking, God, if we were all like in 1979 or 80 in the same bar going, you know, someday we're going to be in a spiritual movement together, we'd like fall over laughing, right? They're like, no way, you know. No way. Because what we'd hear is like, we're going to share a dogma and some rules and a religion. We're going to form a little cult together. And we're looking around going, that's very unlikely. But that isn't what happened. We came to the place with the most space you could possibly have to believe in the power that's so freaking obvious. That's part of the problem. When a new guy, I try not to be sarcastic, but I'm Irish. You know? Right, Paul? And when a new guy comes to me and says, I don't believe in God, I'm like vibrating, going, yeah, man, if I lived like you, I wouldn't either. Like, you're a mess. Yeah. So my experience with recovery and with the the ninth step, I want to talk about right away. I got sober May 16th, 1993, and this beautiful little girl, Phoebe Rose, was born May 16th, 1993, and she's my daughter. And her mom and I were not in love. We had a very electric relationship. But we didn't, it was a disaster. In fact, the day I met my daughter, I'd woken up thinking I was going to rehab. I only answered the phone because I thought it was my ride to rehab, and it was the woman who said, "Your daughter was born." I have to tell this for Tammy because she brought it up. I had a car trouble. You remember alcoholic car trouble? I had the key that said AMC on it. I didn't know where the big mechanism that attached to the other side was, and that's car trouble. I can't find my car. But I got a call that I needed to go to the hospital, which was far from me. So I'd been drinking all night. I woke up on the floor, and I picked up this key, and I ran out into the sunlight going, "Here, car, 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 car." And through the grace of God, I found that car. And I went right to the wrong hospital. You know, I love this. I've read the book with a bunch of people, and after I got over my sensitivity and defensiveness, I realized when it says alcoholics are selfish and self-centered, I went to the hospital where I was born. They weren't there. They were never going to be there. But in the mind of Matthew, that's where babies come from, you know. So I drove very deliberately and confidently to the wrong hospital. I'm hungover. I got clothes I've been wearing for 3 days. I went in that hospital and yelled at the lady, thinking that would make these people appear upstairs. And I went back very dejected and suicidal, honestly. I actually thought about killing myself in my car because I couldn't find my child. And honestly, I didn't want to get sober. I was afraid. I'd agreed to do it a week before. And started up my car, and the name of the right hospital came into my head. And I think that's grace. And I drove to the right hospital. And when I met my daughter and her mom, they were very beautiful. Like, there's no doubt. You know, I'm an artist. I recognize beauty. I can feel it. And I didn't feel connected to them. And when she jumped up, her mom, and she brought that baby to me, they were so lovely and so perfect and so innocent that I just felt disgusting. And I didn't know that I was in the bondage of self. I didn't know that. And what I've learned about that, working with people in AA and being to a lot of these kind of things and sponsoring guys and being sponsored, is when you're in the bondage, when I'm in the bondage of self, I paint everything with my ugliness. I'm a thief. You're probably a thief. I'm a liar. You're a liar. I'm a cheat. You're a cheat. It makes me safe. I just paint you with my disgusting ugliness. And with these two people that day, the paint would not stick. They were real. They were present. My trick didn't work, and I wanted to get away from them. And I fled them. I actually lied to the mother of my daughter. I said, "Everything's going to be all right." And what I really thought is, "Don't worry, I'm going to be dead in 20 minutes. I'm going home to take care of this." And I raced home. I ran up my stairs, and my brother was standing on my porch, ready to take me to rehab. Grace. Just happens. I had no power over that. So I go to rehab. I was 108 pounds when I walked in. I gained 47 pounds in 30 days. Yeah. I did this stuff in rehab. It was so weird. I ate during the day, you know. And I slept at night. Yeah. It was really cool. Yeah. I'd wondered where it had been all my life. So I got 30 days. I came out. I couldn't go back to my apartment. I ended up moving in with my mom and my dad. I start going to meetings, and I'm like 90 days sober. And I have this sponsor, and he used to give me rides to meetings because my AMC died by the side of the road. And we're walking into a meeting, and I said, "You know, I think I love Phoebe more than I've ever loved anybody else, my daughter." And he just walked by me. And I remember I walked into that meeting. It was the Wednesday night men's stag. And I remember thinking, I did not know he was deaf in his left ear, you know. Like, he didn't even look at me. And I'm a little bit self-centered, and I'm watching him across the room. I'm waiting for him to validate me with a nod or a smile, and nothing happens. And we're walking out of that meeting that night, and I said, "You know, you may not understand because you don't have children, but I think I love her more than I love myself." And he goes, "Oh, please." And I said, "What?" And he goes, "How much child support do you pay?" And I go, well, I work at a newspaper from midnight to 4 in the morning, stacking newspapers on a loading dock. And then I sleep for a little while. Then I deliver packages and I go to meetings. He goes, wow, you just described your circumstances. How much child support do you pay? I said, I don't pay any. And he goes, then you're kind of full of it, aren't you? I said, what do you mean? And he said, this is AA, man. You go to 3 meetings a day. You must have heard this is a program of action. This is not a program of talk. Why don't you show me you love your daughter and you'll never have to tell me again? Yeah, whatever. And I thought I'd come so far in 90 days, you know. Because when I was running down the stairs of that hospital, I said a prayer. God, make it so these women never see me again. I'm going to hurt them. I'm not even going to mean to do it. And I'm going to do something stupid. And I ran off thinking I was going to be dead in a few minutes. And here I am 90 days sober trying to convince a guy I'm a good guy because I love my daughter. So we got in his car, and it was a very quiet drive home. He was living in the present moment, and I was planning his death. Well, not for selfish reasons, but I had confided a lot in him. And like Teresa said, some selfishness is good. I wanted to stay sober, and he can't walk the earth because I got to get a new sponsor, and he's going to tell people stuff. And I get home to my parents' house, and I'm pacing around my old bedroom at my parents' house, where it's very hard to hold on to righteous indignation, by the way. Yeah. When you're 30 years old, walking around your old bedroom, yelling at your poster of Eric Clapton you put up when you were 12, you know, I'm like, this guy's an idiot. He clearly doesn't understand me, and he has no emotional depth, you know. And Eric was great. I don't know if Eric was sober by then, but the poster was very helpful. He just smiled at me. Like, and about the fifth lap I made around my room, I thought, my face is red because he's right. There is no evidence that I love my daughter. I want people to like me, so I say I love my daughter. Now, I did. I had changed a little in 90 days, but I hadn't changed much. So that night I called her, Anna, and she was going to be going off to college in the fall. I got sober in May. And I said, hey, you know, I don't make much money, but I should probably give you some money to help with thieving. She goes, oh, my God, that would be so great. She goes, this is harder than I thought it would be, and we're trying to go off to school. And I said, okay, how much do you want? And she goes, oh, no, let's not do it that way. And I go, okay. I go, what? And she goes, well, let's do a percentage of your paycheck. Now, I had no idea that this girl was betting on my horse. I thought I was going to work at the newspaper and be happy, joyous, and free living with my parents till I was 70, you know. But she's like, this guy has potential. And she said, whatever you're making, just give me this percentage. And it was very fair. So every 2 weeks, I went over there. I had to go every 2 weeks because I belonged to that club where they wouldn't let me have a bank account, you know. And I don't know if they have them here in Tennessee, but there's these places that say, we'll cash your check because you're such a loser and we're going to take part of it, right? And I was making no money, so they gave me less than no money, and I'd leave there. And I knew if I didn't go right to Anna's parents' house and pay this child support that I wouldn't do it. Guy knew me. So I'd run over there and I'd give him the money, and you know, I wasn't really motivated to be a good person, but I was motivated to do that because partly when my sponsor said that, I felt like I might be risking my recovery. But also because when I paid the money, I could walk by those people with a little bit of dignity. And then Anna would hand Phoebe to me, and Phoebe was the only person that didn't have an agenda or a predisposed notion of me being a loser. I've been sober as long as she was alive, and she was 3 months old, and she thought I was awesome. I came over, I brought money, I played on the ground with her, rolled around, and honestly, the only spiritual experience I had for a while was playing with that little girl, because I didn't like me. I put on a good show, but I'm newly sober. I've wrecked my life. I was a successful touring musician. And then by the time I got sober, I'd lost so many jobs that were beneath me. Remember that? Like you're interviewing, going, I can't believe I'm taking this stupid job. And then 3 months later, like, yeah, we got to fire you. Like, you can't even do this. In fact, that's how I made Phoebe. I was the manager of a Marie Callender's, and her mom was a waitress. And so the moral of the story is don't take any jobs that are beneath you. You'll end up with a family. And so I didn't like me, and I'm paying this child support. And then Phoebe was a year old, and I was playing with Phoebe because she was going off to school again with her mom. And I said, Phoebe, I'm your dad. I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. I'm going to take you to your first day of every grade. When you're 16, I'm going to buy you a car. Now, I did not have a car when I made that promise, but I had 16 years to figure that out. And I saw things happening in your lives, and I said, you know, and I'm going to be your dad for the rest of your life. I was so happy. This was a year later, and I realized that God had answered my prayer. Because I took my sponsor's direction and showed up every 2 weeks with a check, those two women never saw that guy again. I'm not that guy. Now, I'm not saying that paying child support is a ninth step, but it kind of is. Because I had been unkind to them, and I had used that situation for my benefit while being unkind to them. And I amended my behavior and started supporting them and showing them through my actions that I was with them and I would not let them down. And Anna, we got married around the same time to different people, and I took Phoebe to her first day of first grade, and I cried like a baby. And I took her to her first day of second grade, and I cried like a baby. And in sixth grade, she goes, Dad, could you wait out here? And I go, why? And she goes, you're just hard to explain. Yeah. She was in sixth grade. She was talking to me like she's Bill Moyers or something, you know. I'm like, okay, I'm hard to, I'll just wait in the car, you know. I bought her a car when she was 16, and she totaled that car. I have not bought her another car. And but I will say this, in March of this last year, a year ago, she said, Dad, I need you and Pip, that's my wife, I need you to get up here to Portland. My daughter's a nurse in Portland. I said, okay. And she goes, I want you to stay at this particular hotel. I said, you got it, baby. And we talk all the time. I got Pip in the car. We went to the airport. We got to that hotel. I called her, said, we're here. And she goes, okay, I may be calling you tomorrow. I can't see you tonight. I said, that's okay. She called me the next morning. She said, Dad, it's time. I said, okay. And she said, come on down. And I went to the right hospital, and Phoebe gave birth to my grandson. And I was sitting there with her, and we were just looking at each other. And the room was filled with love. The room was filled with joy, and it wasn't about me at all. Because the bondage of self is what keeps me from seeing the grace. And the only way to get rid of the bondage of self is to live a spiritual life. It doesn't matter what you think about God or religion or whatever. Make restitution to the people you've harmed. I paid child support like clockwork. And I thought, she's 18, it's over. And my Anna said, yeah, but now we got college. So much more expensive than child support. So I paid for college. I even paid for the year where she took off and smoked pot and didn't tell anybody. Yeah. That was fun. And then Phoebe was working two jobs at a long-term care facility for Alzheimer's patients, and I thought, my daughter, my little, you know, entitled blonde daughter from Hermosa Beach is not going to do well with Alzheimer's patients. And she called me like 3 months in. She said, hey, I'm employee of the month. I said, really? And she goes, yeah, I just got this grunt job. I make minimum wage, but I love it here. She called me the next month. Hey, I'm employee of the month. I said, that's great, baby doll. And she goes, yeah, I passed. By the way, I passed the drug test. And I was like, I said, oh, we kind of expect you to do that. Yeah. Anyway, she said, Dad, I'm going to go to nursing school. And I said, that's great. How are you going to pay for that? Because I just paid for a year of pot smoking. You know, I wasn't super excited with my checkbook. And her mom and I met with each other because we parented well together. We would have killed each other as a couple, but we really parented well together. Bill gave me a lot of direction early days, and we really parented well together. And I went to her mom and said, what do you think about nursing school? She goes, I don't think we should pay for it. I go, I don't either, but do you feel a little weird about that? And she said, why don't we wait and see? So we got her first quarter grades, and they were straight A's, and she was working two jobs. And we said, honey, we'll pay for the rest of this. And she's a psych nurse, one of the hardest jobs there is in nursing. And she loves it. Yeah, let's hear it for God, right? So well before I made a list of people I had harmed, that happened, right? And I felt that thing that Frank felt in Keswick, England, and that Sam felt in China. I felt that lightness. I felt that connectedness to things from just simply doing things that to make restitution for the harm I'd done. I remember there was a couple of things before I made my list. Anna and Phoebe went off to Chico, right, in Chico, California. Anybody know about Chico State University? Right. The motto at Chico State, it's such a party school. The motto is, I think I went to Chico State. And I had gone there, I think. And I graduated from Amherst because I wanted to look like an academic stud. I just partied for 3 years and then transferred to Amherst. But they were up in Chico. So I went up to see them. I wanted to see Phoebe, and she was cute. She's starting to walk and stuff, and Anna was being a good student. Anna was a good mom, really good mom. And Chico has a main street and a Broadway. Main goes this way, Broadway comes this way. And I kept trying to do everything via Broadway, which is hard to maneuver. And I realized I couldn't go down Main Street because when I lived in Chico, I worked in the bookstore there, Tower Books. It was Tower Records and Tower Books. And I had gotten fired, most humiliating firing, because I was stealing from them. Because I would spend all my money on drinking, and then I'd need rent money, and I'd just steal from them. And I got fired, and I realized I couldn't go up that street because of shame. So I called my sponsor and said, he goes, how's it going? I go, it's going okay. I love being with Phoebe. Anna's being very cool about everything. But I got this problem, and I told him about it, and he said, well, you're not on the ninth step, but you're there. And you need to make an amends to that place. I said, okay. And he said, I go, what do I do? And he goes, since it's your first amends, I'm going to give you a little space. I want you to go in there and say, I'm trying to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm supposed to make a list of people I've harmed and be willing to make amends to them. You're on my list. And I think I stole this much. And I had about $200, I thought. So I think I stole this much money. And then he said, then you have to say, is there anything else? Right? I'm going to pay it back. Is there anything I left out? So I went in there, and the two people I had to make amends to weren't there. They were at lunch. And I was so afraid. You know, I was new and back in Chico, which was weird, and I'm pacing around in the bookstore, and people are looking at me that used to work with me. I hadn't been there in years, but there were still people there that I knew. And they came in, and they were surprised to see me. It was the manager and the assistant manager. I had also been a manager when I got fired. And I said, hey, I need to talk to you. They were so surprised to see me. And we went back in this little room, a tiny little office. We're all knee-to-knee in the back. And I did it. I was so nervous. I just said what my sponsor said. And I said, you know, I stole money. I stole a little more money than you're aware of, right? And I think I owe about $200. If you know, I can't pay you right away, but I can give you earnest money. Is there anything else? And the woman who was the manager who took my place, actually, she said, I'm just so happy. I mean, we just knew you were a nice person, and we just saw how sick you were, and I'm just happy you're here. And the other guy was just glaring at me. He was an older guy, and I go, what's wrong, Jeff? And he goes, I've been trying to stop drinking for 20 years in AA. I can't get a week, and you're sitting here making amends to me? Grace. And I said, Jeffrey, I don't know much about this, but I'll give you my phone number if I can help. And I wrote my phone number down, and I handed it to him, and he went, oh, that's long distance, and he threw it away. I thought, I don't know why you're not staying sober. But I could walk down the street in Chico, and I can still walk down the street in Chico. I had that little moment where I was lifted and I could maneuver through the town. And I still hadn't made my list. So then I made my list of people I'd harmed, right? And I'm living with my parents, and my mother's dying of cancer. And I'm going to 3 meetings a day. I'm comforting my father when my mother goes to bed at night. Because they've been married for 50 years. He doesn't want to lose her. And I'm hanging out with mom and trying to be a good son. I felt awkward all the time. Remember when you're new, how awkward you feel all the time. And I made this list, and they were on my list. So that was, he goes, go do that. You're right there. Just go ask for a moment with them. Ask if you can meet them in the morning and sit down with them. And we talked over how I'd harmed them. And I thought of stuff. And he said, don't forget, ask if there's anything else. And I said, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to ask if there's anything else. So I go in there. We have a little breakfast meeting. And they're sitting there, and they're real weird all of a sudden. They're like real tentative with me. And we have a very loving family. And I'm looking at him, and I go, okay, I'm just going to do this. And I told him all my stuff and said, is there anything else? And, you know, I was the kid that I'd get a parking ticket in my dad's car, and I would just put that in my pocket because I wouldn't want him to see that. And I didn't know that when he went to register his car, it cost like $700 because he had like 5 parking tickets. I just thought they went away into the universe, you know. So that kind of stuff was on there. Things I did that hurt them was on there. Ways I lied to them was on there. And I said, is there anything else? And they were real quiet. And they go, no, they're looking down at the table. No, it's all good. It's fine. And I go, what is wrong? And my mother looks at my father and goes, we thought you were going to try to borrow a bunch of money. Yeah. And I immediately thought, shit, I could have borrowed a bunch of money. Yeah. And I said, well, why would I do that? And my dad said, well, son, we've heard that you owe a lot of money. I said, yeah, Dad, and I'm going to go do this with them. It's what I'm going to do. Don't worry. And I did owe a lot of money. And time went on, you know, and I had my list. And oh, this is important. On my list, I wrote this guy, Larry, and I wrote $15,000, right? I owed him $15,000. Now, at the time when I wrote that, it looked like $10 million, right? Because I never had $15,000, right? And I'd like to say, after being sober for 30 years, I don't owe everybody a bunch of money. I've gotten sober and become so successful, I just owe banks a bunch of money now. That's called success in America. I'm clean, yeah. So this guy, I owed him $15,000, and I said, I don't think I can do this. And he goes, why not? And I go, I don't have $15,000. And he said, what do you think? You're going to, like, show up to their house with a briefcase and go, here's your $15,000? And I kind of did. I kind of thought I had to get the money together. And he said, where does this guy live? And at the time, he lived in Mexico City. And what I had done is he and I had rent an apartment together, and I had pretended that my check kept getting lost in the mail while he was paying the rent, and I had stolen some of his things and sold them, and just regular bad guy stuff. And he goes, so you think you owe him $15,000? And I said, yeah, I think that's how much I owe him. And he goes, okay, how much could you pay him if you could pay him today? I go, I don't know. And I have 20 bucks. I got 20 bucks on me. And he goes, would 20 bucks change your lifestyle if you gave it to him today? And I said, no, I live with my parents. You know, I'm not partying any, you know. So he goes, well, let's write a letter. So he goes, I want you to write a letter. I want you to own all the behavior. And I want you to send him the 20 bucks. So, sorry, Bill's sponsor is calling. I said, okay, so I wrote this long, beautiful letter. I have a degree in English and a degree in religious studies. I can write a good letter. And I gave it to him, and he looked at it and started laughing and started crossing stuff out. It turns out you can't even sneak in any self-justification at all, even if it's very well written. You know. So he just edited this letter down to, it wasn't much of a letter when he got done with it. I was a little embarrassed, and he said, rewrite it with just that stuff that I didn't cross off and put 20 bucks. So I mailed him the 20 bucks with that letter. And like 4 or 5 weeks later, I see my sponsor at a meeting, and he goes, hey, did you send Larry any money? I go, yeah, remember, I sent him 20 bucks. He goes, no, did you send him any more money? I said, no. And he goes, well, send him more money. So that night, I sent him 20 more bucks, and I wrote a little note. And then I decided, I think I'm supposed to do this regularly. And I got a little notebook, and I wrote the date and the money I sent back. And I learned something about myself. When I'm stealing from you, I'm a little vague about the numbers, you know. It's not that important. You know, 5,000, 10,000, But when I'm paying you back, I'm meticulously keeping track. I matured into a man of detail. Yeah. So I'm writing these letters and sending $20. Then I got a better job, and I got more child support. Larry got more money. All boats rise, right? So I'd send him $50, and I'd write it down. And honestly, sometimes I'd forget and realize, shoot, I'd be in a meeting, and someone would mention the ninth step, and I'd go, oh, my God. And I'd send him $100. So there were gaps, and I just sent him money. He didn't respond. I just sent him money. And I got a checking account. That was cool. That's the beginning of owing banks money. And I started sending him checks. And I got married. I helped my mother die. I started doing panels and stuff. I had a little baby with my wife, and Anna and Phoebe were the first people at the hospital. I was chugging along, you know. And my father was really sad when my mother died. And he didn't know if he could go on much longer. And I got a phone call around that time from Larry. And he had moved back to the United States. He lived in Laguna Niguel. And he said, hey, can you please stop sending me these checks? And I said, why? And I got the notebook out. And while he's talking, he's going, look, I love you. I've always thought you were a good man. No one's ever paid me back money they owe me. You're done. You're a good father. You're a good husband. You're a good son. And I said, Larry, I've only paid you $7,000. I'd added it up. I go, I owe you $8,000 more. And he said, I'm here to tell you, no, you don't. You've paid me back. So I made the mistake of calling my sponsor. This is a cautionary tale. Don't work at restaurants and don't call your sponsor. And I called him and I go, hey, I'm done paying Larry back. He goes, oh my God, I can't believe it. Really? And I go, yeah. And he goes, that guy you paid $20 a month to you when you lived with your parents? Again, he goes, that's amazing. And he goes, so you paid him all the money back? Well, as far as he's concerned, I did. And he said, what does that mean? And I told him, and he goes, so let me get this straight. You've been paying that guy back, and your life gets better and better and better. Hey, man, you want to stop doing what's working? That's cool. That was an $8,000 phone call. I've never had one since. My father died right in front of me about 3 weeks later. And he told me before he died, there's some checks up there. I need you guys to cash. I want to not just pay so much taxes. I'm leaving you. And there was a check for $10,000. I miss my dad. So I went home to my wife, my beautiful wife. My wife is British and funny and elegant and lovely. And we got this little kid. We just had another one. And I said, hey, we got this money today. And I want to give most of it to Larry. She goes, why? And I said, well, I have to do that. Like, I have to do this. If it would be okay with you. And we needed it. We were a young family. We worked living paycheck to paycheck. Happy as clams. I mean, no problem. But not, we had no money, you know. And she was doing the dishes. And she looked over at me and said, baby, I've never lived like you live. She's not alcoholic. She's not an A. She said, I've never lived the way we live. It's so cool the way we live. If you need to give him that money, give him the money. See, there's a pond here. There's ripples here. I didn't know that the guys living in my trailer that I was reading the book with were teaching my children to be compassionate. I didn't know that the things I did to straighten out our problems as a family, coming straight from you guys, where my wife was paying attention going, this is really a good way to live. So I sent Larry a check for $8,000. I FedExed it because you can't trust that mail, you know. And Larry called me and he said, "You're not going to believe this." And I said, "What?" And he said, "We found out last night that Wendy, my wife, is pregnant." And he said, and we've been renting this house here in Laguna Niguel, and we wanted to buy it. So I stayed up last night trying to figure out if we had a down payment. And we were $8,000 short. So the loser, the thief, got to help this good man buy his first house with his own money. I hate that part of the story. It takes all my Jimmy Stewartness out of me, you know. But, you know, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I am free and I am happy. We will not regret the past nor wish to close the door on it. I do not. We will comprehend the word serenity. Do you notice that? We will finally understand the word. Because if we're living a life of owing and feeling less than and feeling like a secret, we can't know serenity. We will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will know how our experiences can benefit others. This is my favorite. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. You know why we walk up here with confidence? Because we do this work and we're excited about it. And we want to share it with you. I am not useless. I do not feel sorry for myself. My wife got paralyzed in an accident 21 years ago. And we're as happy. I put my marriage up against anybody's marriage. When you do this work, when I did this work, my circumstances no longer dictated my happiness. I've been through it. Teresa's going through it right now, and we know she's going to be okay. Part of the reason we know she's going to be okay is she came up here and she copped to it, right? Bill knows everything there is to know about me. I have no secrets. I'm free. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. The bondage of self evaporates. The last thing I wanted to say to make a point about this is when Frank Buchman made those amends, he regained the power to help others. The channel was open. When Sam Shoemaker made amends to his Chinese class, he started to be able to help them. Jim Newton saved Bud Firestone, who was helpless. Henrietta Cyberling introduced Bob to Bill. The power, the energy, it flows. And I just want to put it to you tonight, when you're walking back to wherever you're going after this, if you're holding back on an amends, if you're not living the spiritual life out of fear, who is it that's not being helped by you? The one thing I wanted to say about our currency is because our only currency is our experience, every one of us is precious. I was in a meeting when I was a year sober. It was a circular meeting. There was this guy sitting there shaking, tapping his foot, fidgety, and there's a guy sitting next to him. We called on the fidgety guy, and he said, "Oh, my God, I'm 16 days sober. I'm losing my mind." He goes, I just got a license. Nobody cares. I live in the back room at my parents' house. My car doesn't work. I don't know about this." The next guy in line, this is a true story, he said, "I'm 17 days sober. Keep coming back. It gets better." That happened. That guy is precious. Making amends, you just polish your diamonds, man. Please go polish your diamonds. Thanks for letting me share.